Greetings. Any questions? So can you see those squiggles in the top right and bottom left corners? Good. So we began to have a look last time at gravitational waves. I wouldn't say it was surprising because to some extent, Einstein was working very much on the analogy with electromagnetism, and electromagnetism, of course, had waves in it. And relativity said that influences had to propagate at the velocity of light, maximum speed, and about the only way you could think of doing that is having field equations and having waves that transmitted the information from one place to the next. It was impossibly small, and I think Einstein never expected them to be detected. And it did take 100 years. So anyway, we started with the field equations. Okay, let me continue as with last time. I'll use Greek indices for 0, 1, 2, 3, 0 being time, etc. And U. Equals 0 as a coordinate condition. In fact, this coordinate condition can be raised up to be a condition on the full metric. it's a coordinate condition on the full metric, which says that the ordinary derivative of the square root of the determinant of the matrix that represents the metric times the inverse metric, G upper mu nu, is equal to zero. If we linearize this, if we take the linear, you know, G mu nu equals eta mu nu plus H mu nu, then G upper mu nu is equal to eta upper mu nu minus H upper mu nu, where we'll recall that we raise H upper mu nu is eta mu nu, u rho eta nu lambda H rho lambda. We raise and lower indices by means of the flat metric, the background metric. Eta, remember, is the matrix 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, minus 1, minus 1, is what eta mu nu is. So it basically just changes the spatial components by making them into their negative. And to lowest order root G is 1/2 of eta mu nu, the trace of H. So this G upper mu nu is minus H mu nu. This gives me a 1/2. This guy linear is just H bar. Mu nu. So that gives us this one. This is called the harmonic coordinate condition . Why is that? If we look at d mu d mu times a scalar, that turns out to be one over root G ordinary derivative root G, G upper mu nu, d mu times phi. If we go through the various definitions and the Christoffel symbols and so forth, you find this is what box phi. If we now, so let me call, yeah. So if we now choose our coordinates, the coordinates are just functions on the space, some set of four functions. This is not a vector index, it's just labeling them from 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. Then this is just 1/√g times root g. It's always absolute value inside there. Oh. Forgot the derivative, sorry. X row, but this is just delta new row. And so this just becomes 1/√g d mu times root g g mu rho. And if we demand that the coordinates be functions which obey the basically the wave equation, so if x rho obeys the wave equation, then t mu root g g mu rho is equal to 0. So this is sort of the nonlinear generalization of that condition that h bar is equal to 0. If you plug this into the Christoffel symbols, you find that it reduces the number of Christoffel symbols by a lot. Well, that's a sideline. So we got box of h bar mu equals minus 8 pi times t mu is what we found that the linearized Einstein equations looked like. And we have the condition that d mu h bar mu nu is equal to 0. Now, if we have, as we said last time, if we have a coordinate condition, then h mu nu goes to h mu nu plus zeta d mu zeta nu plus d mu zeta mu. And h bar goes to h bar mu nu plus d mu, zeta mu plus d mu, zeta mu minus d rho, zeta rho, eta mu. And d mu, oops, that's h bar, d mu h bar mu mu goes to h bar mu plus box times zeta mu. D mu. So therefore, we know we can always find a coordinate transformation which will make sure that H bar obeys this condition up here. Generically, it doesn't, but we can always find a coordinate an infinitesimal coordinate transformation so that it obeys that equation. The same is true for the generalization. You can always find a coordinate transformation, in that case, a full coordinate transformation, just by choosing those harmonic coordinates such that full metric obeys that so-called harmonic coordinate condition. But this still leaves us a lot of freedom, as we mentioned last time. And in particular, we need to make sure that all following coordinate transformations are going to obey that condition, that the box of the coordinate transformation is equal to zero. But that still leaves us a lot of freedom. For example, we could define my infinitesimal coordinate transformation in such a way that it's simply equal to the gradient of some field where box of phi is equal to zero. Then box of zeta mu is going to be equal to zero, and it's going to preserve the other coordinate transformation. But what we find is that if we look at h, which is of course eta mu nu times h mu nu, which is minus eta mu nu times h bar, and under this transformation, we find that H goes to H plus I've gotten myself confused here. Yeah, I don't want this. This goes to twice d mu theta mu. Why did I get myself confused? Let me get rid of these. They're not right. Well, I'm just going to have to do proof by blatant assertion. I can find zeta such that d mu zeta mu equals minus 1/2 h and box zeta mu is equal to 0. This we need in order that H bar still obeys that coordinate condition. And this we need to get rid of the trace. I'll have to think on my own time. Okay. So proof by blatant assertion, I will try if it suddenly comes to me how to do it properly. I know it's true. Okay. So if trace is zero, so I can do a coordinate transformation such that the trace is equal to 0. And I can do a coordinate transformation. Yeah. So now I'm going to do another coordinate transformation in which I'm going to try to get rid of H naught naught and H naught I. The first thing we want is that d mu zeta mu is equal to 0. And I can write that as the time derivative of zeta 0. Zeta zero lower is the same as zeta zero up because you raise and lower with eta. And for time, for the zero component, that's equal to 1. Minus grad dot zeta, where here I'm defining the vector zeta as being equal to the vector zeta 1, zeta 2, zeta 3. The minus sign comes in there because for the spatial terms, eta spatial has minus ones in them. Now, H not I. So this one, this condition, I want so as to preserve H equals 0, because H transforms under the divergence of this upper vector field. H0i is the D0 zeta I plus DI zeta 0. And I also want to make sure that box of all the zeta are equal to 0. And I want to make sure that this is true. Now I can take a derivative of this, dt h0i is equal to d naught squared zeta I plus di d naught zeta naught. But d naught zeta naught is given by this equation. And this thing obeys the wave equation. So this thing becomes grad squared zeta I plus grad dot zeta naught. Now, this has a sort of an inverse. If I do di dj sum over j of dt h not I, minus twice di sum over not over j over I. Di dt times h not I. This is the sum over I. That turns out to be grad to the fourth of zeta I. So this is grad squared. And grad to the fourth is grad squared squared. So this is grad squared.
Sorry, how did partial zero become grad squared? Or partial zero squared become grad squared?
You're summing over I. Right? So this is d squared by dx squared plus d squared by dy squared plus d squared by dz squared is this guy, right?
Yeah.
On the right-hand side, I've got to apply the same set of operators onto the right-hand side. It turns out, so this guy here is, what do I want? This guy here is di. So I apply this operator, di dj, on both of these sides, which means I have to sum over I again to take the derivative with respect to di dj over here, sum over i's, etc. All of the terms which are the gradient, sorry, are the divergence of zeta cancel out. And all I get left with is two of these nabla squared.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm applying this di dj minus twice nabla squared on both sides. This is, of course, not I, this is j. I apply this on both sides, all of the terms cancel, and I'm just left with this. But this, I know what it is. It's dt to the fourth, right? Each nabla squared is equal to, sorry, not that one. Since this obeys box, which is dt squared minus nabla squared on zeta mu equals zero, this guy, where am I? This guy is just, each one of these brings a dt squared. So this whole thing just becomes dt to the fourth. I have a dt on the left-hand side, so I can cancel out one of those dt's. And I find that if I choose zeta I is the triple integral of, no, call this J instead, DI DJ DI H not I minus twice DI DI H not J DT DT dt. Then that spatial cord, those case spatial coordinates satisfy the equations. That of course also tells us what zeta naught is, because dt of zeta naught is di of zeta I. I've of course got a sum over I in all of these cases. So I can find zeta naught by taking another integral of this guy. So we're going to get four integrals over time. And so what does that give us? This sets eta zero I equals zero, h is equal to zero, and di h, sorry, d mu h mu nu is equal to zero. And box of H is now equal to zero because the trace is equal to zero. H is the same as H bar. Hij. Sorry, H. Mu nu. All components are equal to zero. But from this, it also tells me that D naught, H naught, I, A, sorry, H naught naught equals DI, H naught I. Well, that's a minus sign in there. But these are all zero. So that tells me that D naught of H naught naught has to be equal to zero. Or we can take H naught naught equal to zero as long as we remember that there might be an additional constant of integration. So this tells us that box of H, IJ, H not I equals H not not equals zero. So it's only the IJ that are not equal to zero anyway. And also H II is equal to zero. That comes from H equals zero. And since H naught naught is zero, H equals zero is just the sum over I of HII, which are equal to zero. So that tells us, and also that D I H I J is equal to zero. So what this gives us is 2 degrees of freedom. Or 2 arbitrary constants of integration, if you will. If H, for example, depends only on Z and T, then H of Z I are going to be equal to zero. Unless they're constants, independent of everything. And that means that we've only got HXX, HYY, and HXLY as possibilities. But the trace equals zero says that, so this is only HXX, HXY, HYY are the only possible things that it can be left over. But the trace tells that HXX plus HYY has got to be equal to zero. And so the metric is going to look like, H is going to look like, HXX minus HXX, HXY, and HXY. So there are 2 degrees of freedom. So we started out with 10. Then we used their coordinate freedom and the fact that these obey the equations of motion to reduce everything down to just 2 degrees of freedom. So just as in electromagnetism, electromagnetic waves have only 2 degrees of freedom. Similarly, the gravitational system only has 2 degrees of freedom. So H of XX or H of XY, this is of course equal to minus H of YY, are the two polarizations. These are called shears. H represents the volume. Change. And that's equal to zero. So these are shape changes. So if I have a little square here, and the gravity wave is coming in through the into the page, so direction of propagation, into page. This will, H of YY is how much the distances change in the Y direction. So it's going to get smaller. And the X direction is going to get bigger. A little bit later, it could look like this. Area remains the same. But, you know, it converts from a square to a rectangle. That's this polarization. And the other polarization takes this square, expands it in the XY direction at 45 degrees, and changes this to something that looks like this, or the opposite. Now, as you showed in the midterm, in a specific example, but this is true in general, if the metric is G mu nu is equal to, you know, eta mu nu plus h mu nu, then x equals y equals z equals constant, or rather x comma y comma z are all constants, is a geodesic. So in this coordinate system, if you stick down free particles and don't put any forces on them, they just stay at the same coordinate position. They don't move when the gravity wave goes by. But of course, the distance changes. In the x direction, for example, the direction is 1 minus h x x over 2 times delta x between two particles. The over 2 is because you've taken a square root and then linearized that square root. So the distance between the particle changes as the gravity wave comes by. But their location in the coordinate system doesn't change at all. If we have a bar type gravity wave detector, a solid, and the gravity wave comes through there, all the gravity wave does is doesn't put any forces on the particles. The particles just sit there, but it changes the distance between them. And it changes the distance in such a way that, you know, the volume doesn't change, but the shape changes. But the atoms in a solid want to preserve free So they start exerting forces on each other as the gravity wave goes by. For an isotropic solid, this is because of this what's called the shear modulus, which tends to try to preserve the shape. Now, the shear modulus is not the same as the compression, because remember, the gravity wave doesn't change volumes, so the particles aren't being compressed. No compression. But if they like to preserve their shape a lot, that means they have a high shear modulus, they're going to exert a lot of force on each other when the gravity wave comes by and tries to change the shape of the system, the distance between the particles in such a way that the shape changes. A material which gives one a feeling for the difference between the so-called shear and the compression is Jell-O. You've all seen Jell-O, I presume. Jell-O has the compressibility of water. It's incredibly stiff. Velocity of sound in water is like 3 kilometers per second. It's a very stiff medium. You go down to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, which is, you know, 10 kilometers down under the surface of the ocean, and the water compresses by about 50%. It's an incredible pressure down there, but it doesn't compress the water very much. On the other, so Jell-O, you can't compress it, but its shape changes very easily, right? I mean, you just jiggle it a little bit and the shape is changing all over the place as the thing woggles back and forth. So Jell-O has very small shear modulus. Which means small force on shape change. But very large bulk modulus. Namely, it resists changes in volume. So Jell-O is exactly the kind of material you don't want to use in a gravity wave detector, because you want these forces that the atoms exert on each other when the shape changes to be as large as possible to get the material moving as the gravity wave goes by. So if there's a large interparticle force on each other. So you want a very stiff material. And the first material that Joe Weber used about 1 ton of aluminum, which was, you know, something about a meter long and a little less than a meter in diameter, a big bar like this. And the hope was that as the gravity wave came by, it would change the shape of this. The atoms inside the material, as their shape changes, would produce counteracting forces against that shape change. And that would start the material moving. And so the after the gravity wave went by, the material would be left. Oscillating. This is, of course, vastly exaggerated. The actual oscillation that Weber claimed to see was about one part in 10 to the 18th. So the shape changed by an absolutely tiny amount. But that would be one way of detecting it. Another way of detecting it would simply be to try and measure the change in distance. And this is the laser interferometer kind of idea. So you have two mirrors here. And as the gravity wave comes by, it changes the length of the distance, the length between this half silver mirror and that mirror, and increases this one, if you have the right polarization, decreases that one, increases this way, and therefore changes the interference pattern in the middle, because you've moved the mirrors. The light has a further distance to go here than it does there, and it takes a longer time. And so you get an interference pattern here that shifts as the gravity wave goes by. This was basically a couple of people, namely a guy by the name of Forward and a guy by the name of Weiss. Forward was the first one to suggest the possibility of using lasers. And Ray Weiss then looked at it in much more detail and looked to see what kind of a system one could set up in order to actually detect the gravitational waves, what the noise sources were and all of that. He, of course, stayed a member of the LIGO team that finally built these guys and got the Nobel Prize about 6 years ago for the detection. 4 years ago for the detection of gravitational radiation. Okay. Weber claimed to see something. A couple of other people built detectors when he claimed to see something. Douglas at Syracuse and Amaldi in Rome also built bar type detectors. They claimed also to see stuff. They ran coincidence experiments between the two of them and claimed to see coincidences, namely a detector in Rome and a detector in, you know, College Park, Maryland. Saw coincidences between the two, which made a lot of people think that they must be seeing something. It made very little sense because the amount of energy that one saw that would need in the gravitational wave to do that would be much more than a solar mass of material being completely converted into gravity waves in the center of our galaxy. And there was no evidence that such extreme things were happening in the center of our galaxy. The other problem was in these coincidence experiments, it turned out that when they first ran the coincidences, they forgot that the two places were on different time standards. You know, daylight, that the And so they were finding coincidences based on the fact that they were an hour apart, which of course gravity waves travel much faster than 1 hour between any place to places on the Earth. Once they corrected that, they said they still got coincidences, at which point everybody got very suspicious. Weber claimed that his events that he saw were, coherent with respect to sidereal time, time with respect to the stars, rather than with respect to the sun. The sidereal day is 1 day and 365 days shorter than the solar day. Than the solar day. So approximately 0.3% shorter than the solar day. And running over a length period of month, he actually saw his events sort of seemed to be moving through the sidereal day, moving through the solar day and keeping track with the sidereal day, which again made people think there must be something he's seeing, and he's seeing stuff that isn't something to do with the Earth, because almost anything having to do with the Earth keeps solar time, not sidereal time. And then other people started coming in and building detectors and seeing absolutely nothing. And after about 5 years of this, the consensus became that Weber was not seeing gravitational waves. Nobody's ever figured out what he was seeing or whether he was seeing figments of his own imagination. He was a very good experimentalist, but something was going badly wrong.
When did this take place? Just curious.
So Weber started his experiments in the late 1950s. He started seeing things in the late 1960s and reporting that he was actually seeing gravitational radiation. And so in the 1970s, a whole bunch of people started building gravity wave detectors, which were on the face of it much more sensitive than Weber's, and saw nothing.
I see.
And for a while, the idea of doing the lasers and doing the bar type detectors were sort of neck and neck. And by about the mid 1980s, it was clear that you would be able to get much higher sensitivity with the lasers than you would with the bar detectors. So by the late 1990s, bar detectors, nobody was running bar detectors anymore. The trouble with laser interferometers was that in order to get the sensitivity, they'd had to be huge. So the one down in, the United States one in Louisiana and one in Washington State, near Hanford, in Washington, Eastern Washington State is where they built them. They're each 4 kilometers long. So they have vacuum tubes, which are over a meter in diameter and 4 kilometers long, which you have to evacuate to the best vacuum on the surface of the Earth. And in fact, it comes close to being better than any vacuum anywhere in the solar system, because there's gas given off by the sun and so forth. So you have to evacuate that to this incredible degree. So they were expensive, which is why it took so long. And it was only in 1915 when they finally improved the sensitivity and particularly improved the seismic isolation. They're so sensitive that they can see the waves breaking on the beaches in, off the coast of the state of Washington, Puget Sound and so forth, or in the Gulf of Mexico near Louisiana. Just the waves jiggling, the waves as they hit the beach jiggle the earth. And they were sensitive enough to be able to see that jiggling of the earth being done by those waves hitting the ocean, the shore. So they had to do incredible seismic isolation, about 300 dB of seismic isolation. That's 10 to the 30th. You had to reduce the energy or the amplitude by one part in 10 to the 15th due to seismic isolation in order to be able to get the sensitivity to see any of this stuff. And that was tough. I'll talk a little bit about that in a later talk. Where are we? Okay, let me start. So I'll talk about some of these experiments. I have a colloquium that I give, and I'll basically give you that colloquium as one of the talks in the lectures in a while. The first, So what causes gravitational radiation? Well, obviously motion of energy. Since energy is conserved, the amount of energy contained in a fixed region doesn't change. No matter how violently it's moving, it's not going to change. So you don't get monopole, and you also don't get dipole radiation because of change of momentum, because of conservation of momentum. But if you get asymmetric kinds of motions of energy, it's going to produce gravitational radiation. So let's look at our equations of motion. Equals minus 8 pi. So this is what we derived a while ago as the linearized equations of motion for linearized Einstein's equations look like this. What we discovered is that it's basically the spatial parts of this that give you the gravity waves. Well, we all know how to solve this using Green's functions. I presume you've all seen the Green's function in your electromagnetism classes for the usual wave, the ordinary wave equation. And that gives us, oh, these are bars, h bar ij is equal to minus 8 pi, let me do 8 pi times the integral of t of t prime and x prime times delta of t minus t prime minus x prime over 4 pi where x minus x prime is the square root of x minus x prime squared plus y minus y prime squared plus It's the distance between the two positions. Well, that 4 pi and that 8 pi cancel to give you a 2. So this is the d cubed x primed dt primed. So this is the standard Green's function solution. Let's assume that x So let's assume that we're very, very far away. And we just want to look to see how, you know, the radiation comes off at very long distance away. Is equal to minus 2 times the integral of delta of t minus x over x t, oops, t minus t prime T of T prime X prime D cubed X So I've neglected X primed over X. So I've assumed that x is very large where I'm looking at it. So this is a function of t and x. Looks like this. Now, di, d mu, h bar mu nu equals 0 t mu nu is a stress energy tensor. It's conserved, so its derivative is equal to 0. And that then immediately implies that this H obeys that equation, which is good because we had to use that in order to find that the Einstein tensor was just box of H equals T mu nu. So this guy's okay. So let's now look at Hij. Is equal to minus 2 over x times the integral of t I j t minus x d cubed x prime. Okay. I'm obviously, that's x, comma x prime. So it's just basically given by the changes of the spatial components of the stress energy tensor. Well, that's sort of hard to get a handle on. And one can use the conservation of the energy stress energy tensor in order to simplify this equation. And let me just write down this trick. Integral of DI. DK X I times T of K J X, these are all primes. I stick a delta IJ, a delta IK in there. The derivative with respect to K of XI is just delta IK, the partial derivative. But now I can do an integration by parts. The energy distribution or the stress energy distribution, we assume is some finite distribution. So when I do that integral, I get the boundary terms are going to be zero because I do the integral over a sufficiently large region that I can do an integration by parts. And that gives me flips the sign because of the integration by parts. These are all primes. But this is equal to d0 of t0k. So what's happened is I've exchanged a derivative of over a spatial index here into an integral over one of the indices becoming like a derivative with respect to time of, in this case, the momentum flux. I can do that once again. And I'm going to get xi xj times second derivative of t. So this is proportional to 2 over x times the integral of xi xj times dt t of 0, 0. Sorry, second derivative. I get a term that looks like this. Well, the derivative with respect to time in there, I can take on the outside. This is a spatial integral here. So this is 2 over x. Second derivative with respect to time of xi xj times t 0, 0. But this is the quadrupole moment of the energy density. That's the quadrupole moment of the energy density. Oops. And we'll look at this, I'll go through this in slightly more detail next time. So what we find is that the energy, that the field is proportional to the second time derivative of the energy, of the quadrupole moment of the energy density. This is very similar to what you do in electromagnetism. In electromagnetism, the electromagnetic radiation is proportional to the first time derivative of the dipole moment, right? And here it's the second moment of the quadrupole moment that becomes important in this case. Let me quit here. I've run out of time. I've gone way over time. Sorry about that. So I guess next lecture is next Tuesday. There's another assignment I think should be up already. Assignment 4.
I don't see it.
You don't see it? All right. Well, it will be there in a few minutes. So that will be due next Thursday. And remember, your midterm redo is due on Tuesday. 23:59. For the midterm renew, there's no extensions. For the final renewal, for the assignment, the standard 5% a day applies. Oh, and I'll also fix up that problem that I had there earlier on in making trace H equals 0. Oh. Okay, unless there are other questions. Oh, good. I recorded this. Just a minute. I have to save my shared screen. Save. Okay. Stop share. Stop recording.